Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello, and welcome to As It Is from VOA Learning English. I'm Christopher Cruz in Washington. Today on the program, we report on how one American political party has come to control the majority of state and national political offices. Republicans now control the U.S. House and Senate, 31 governorships, and 68 state House and Senate chambers.
Put the focus on finding and grooming great talent and promoting them at the state level and talking the issues that matter to people at state and local levels, you know, such as lower taxes. And these are things that have connected with people.
Is America becoming a one-party country? That is the subject of our program today. We're on the radio, on the web, and we come to you on a podcast. We are wherever you are. We're the voice of America, and this is our daily program, As It Is. Barack Obama has won the last two presidential elections. Many Democrats believe Hillary Clinton can win if she campaigns in 2016. Even if she does win, the presidency would be one of the few offices Democrats would hold. Republicans now control a large majority of America's state and national offices, including most of the governor's offices, state legislatures, and the U.S. Congress. This has happened for many reasons. One of them is white voters. Many have been leaving the Democratic Party, especially in the Deep South. Another is Republicans have outspent and outworked Democrats at the local and state levels. The Deep South is an area that includes Alabama, Georgia, Louisiana, Mississippi, North Carolina, and South Carolina. It also includes parts of five other states. They are Florida, Virginia, Tennessee, Arkansas, and Texas. In 1964, Democrats held or controlled almost all of the political offices in the Deep South. That was the same year that President Lyndon Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act into law. The measure gave legal protection to minorities. Experts believe the Civil Rights Act was the main reason for whites leaving the Democratic Party, giving control of the South to the Republicans. In the 2014 election, Democratic Representative John Barrow of Georgia lost to Republican Rick Allen. Mr. Barrow served in Congress for 10 years. He was the last white Democrat serving in the House from the Deep South. Late last year, Louisiana Senator Mary Landrieu lost in her effort to get reelected. Republican Bill Cassidy won her Senate seat. His victory removed the only Democrat to hold statewide office in Louisiana and the last Democratic senator to represent the Deep South. With the victories, Republicans now hold 54 of the 100-seat Senate chamber and 247 of the 435 U.S. House seats. The New York Times newspaper reports that in the Deep South, Republicans control not only every U.S. Senate seat, but also every governor's mansion and almost every state legislative body. The results are not better for Democrats in other parts of the country. There are Republican governors in 31 of the 50 states, including 7 of the 10 largest states. Only California, Pennsylvania, and New York have Democratic governors among the 10 largest states. Even in states where most voters are Democrats, Republicans are having success. In November, voters in 3 Democrat-majority states chose Republican governors. The 3 are Illinois, Maryland, and Massachusetts. The website Real Clear Politics reports that Republicans hold the governorship and both houses of the state legislature in 24 states. Democrats have that same level of control in only 7 states. Republicans also control 68 of 98 House and Senate chambers at the state level. In the elections last November, Republicans gained control of 11 state legislatures that had been held by Democrats. Ruffy Williams is a spokesman for the Republican National Committee. He says the party worked hard to find candidates and identify issues. Republicans, he says,
put the focus on finding and grooming great talent and promoting them at the state level and talking to the issues that matter to people at state and local levels, you know, such as lower taxes. And these are things that have connected with people.
Guy Molyneux does public opinion surveys for Democratic activist groups. He admits Republicans have outworked Democrats at the state level.
I don't think Democrats have, in any sense, ignored the gubernatorial elections or state legislative elections, but I think it's probably a fair summary to say that the constituencies on the Democratic side have not focused as much or as well on those state races.
Republican control of state-level offices has also given them control of redistricting. State and national electoral districts are created in the states. Control of this process permits Republicans to create districts whose voters are more likely to vote for Republican state legislators as well as members of the U.S. House. For example, the new Pennsylvania 7th Congressional District includes parts of 5 different counties. The Republican-controlled legislature created the district with the help of a Republican governor. The shape of the district has been described as an oil spill, roadkill, or a crab. Critics say the district and others were drawn to protect Republican officeholders. The news is not all bad for Democrats. Democrats get large majorities of the votes of African Americans and Hispanics. As the percentage of minority population grows larger than whites, Democrats hope to regain control of the country's politics. However, Guy Molyneux says Democrats know it will be very difficult to succeed without the support of white voters.
Democrats have by no means written off the white vote, and there are reasons that we have to be optimistic about improving our percentages there, but certainly in these off-year elections and in these state legislative races, we definitely need to do better.
On the Republican side, Ruffy Williams says the party has to reach out to minorities, something he says it has not done well in the past.
For a while there, we weren't engaging in minority communities as much as we should have been. Recently, we have been going to African-American, Hispanic, Asian youth communities.
That's our program for today. We hope it has informed and entertained you and has helped you learn everyday American English. I'm Christopher Cruz at the VOA Learning English Headquarters in Washington. We'll be back tomorrow at this same time with another broadcast, webcast, and podcast edition of As It Is from the Voice of America.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Technology Report. Recycling or reusing metals is much less costly than making them from raw materials in the earth called ore. But when old cars, household appliances, and industrial equipment are thrown away, metals are mixed and often difficult to separate. So they are usually placed into landfills without being separated. The United States Environmental Protection Agency says almost 15 million tons of this scrap metal is placed into landfills every year. Although iron and steel are easily separated with strong magnets, other metals, such as copper, aluminum, and titanium, are not. So products with a mix of these metals are either sent to landfills or to other countries, where workers separate the different metals by hand. But university scientists working with a private company say they have created a very accurate method to separate these light metals using a machine. Don Eggert is the founder of O2M Technologies. His company worked with the University of Utah to develop the metal separation technology. Mr. Eggert says the system is based on the knowledge that all metals react to a strong magnetic field.
When the metal falls through the field, even though it's non-ferrous, it's not attracted to the magnet, but the magnet causes there to be an electric current inside of the metal, and that causes the metal to have a magnetic field itself, which interacts with the magnetic field it's falling through and pushes it to the side.
Mr. Eggert says changing the frequency of the magnetic field causes metal pieces to fall into different containers.
So, for example, if we want to separate aluminum and copper, we hit the right frequency for it, and the aluminum will push more away from the magnet than the copper will. So the copper falls straight down, the aluminum falls into a different bucket.
Mr. Eggert says the separator is not costly to build.
What we've calculated so far is that the expense to value ratio, that is, how quickly you can pay back the cost of the technology over time, we're currently estimating it to be less than 1 year.
The separator works only with metal pieces up to 1 centimeter wide. But the researchers are building a bigger magnet to separate larger metal parts. They hope to begin operating it at a metal shredding center by the end of this year. There, they will be able to test it in a real-life environment. And that's the VOA Learning English Technology Report. You can read and listen to more technology stories at our website, learningenglish.voanews.com. I'm Jonathan Evans.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. On November 11th, 1918, a truce was signed ending the hostilities of World War I. The Central Powers, led by Germany, had lost. The Allies, led by Britain, France, and the United States, had won. The war lasted 4 years. It took the lives of 10 million people. It left much of Europe in ruins. It was described as the war to end all wars. This week in our series, Barbara Klein and Doug Johnson tell about President Woodrow Wilson and his part in events after the war.
The immediate task was to seek agreement on terms of a peace treaty. The Allies were filled with bitter anger. They demanded a treaty that would punish Germany severely. They wanted to make Germany weak by destroying its military and industry. And they wanted to ruin Germany's economy by making it pay all war damages. Germany, they said, must never go to war again. President Woodrow Wilson of the United States did not agree completely with the other allies. He wanted a peace treaty based on justice, not bitterness. He believed that would produce a lasting peace. President Wilson had led negotiations for a truce to end the hostilities of World War I. Now, he hoped to play a major part in negotiations for a peace treaty. To be effective, he needed the full support of the American people.
Americans had supported Wilson's policies through most of the war. They had accepted what was necessary to win. This meant higher taxes and shortages of goods. At the time, Americans seemed to forget party politics. Democrats and Republicans worked together. All that changed when it became clear the war was ending. Congressional elections were to be held in November 1918. President Wilson was a Democrat. He feared that Republicans might gain a majority of seats in Congress. If they did, his negotiating powers at a peace conference in Europe would be weakened. Wilson told the nation, "The return of a Republican majority to either House of Congress would be seen by foreign leaders as a rejection of my leadership."
Republicans protested. They charged that Wilson's appeal to voters was an insult to every Republican. One party leader said, "This is not the president's private war." The Republican campaign succeeded. The party won control of both the Senate and the House of Representatives. The congressional elections were a defeat for President Wilson, but he did not let the situation interfere with his plans for a peace conference. He and the other Allied leaders agreed to meet in Paris in January 1919.
In the weeks before the conference, Wilson chose members of his negotiating team. Everyone expected him to include one or more senators. After all, the Senate would vote to approve or reject the final peace treaty. Wilson refused. Instead, he chose several close advisers to go with him to Paris. Today, American history experts say Wilson's decision was a mistake. Failure to put senators on the negotiating team, they say, cost him valuable support later on. In early December, President Wilson sailed to France. The voyage across the Atlantic Ocean lasted 9 days. He arrived at the port of Brest on December 13th. Wilson felt very happy. 13, he said, was his lucky number.
French citizens stood along the railroad that carried him from Brest to Paris. They cheered as his train passed. In Paris, cannons were fired to announce his arrival, and a huge crowd welcomed him there. The people shouted his name over and over again. Wilson! 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 The noise sounded like thunder. French Premier Georges Clemenceau commented on the event. He said, "I do not think there has been anything like it in the history of the world." People cheered President Wilson partly to thank America for sending its troops to help fight against Germany. But many French citizens and other Europeans also shared Wilson's desire to establish a new world of peace. They listened with hope as he made an emotional speech about a world in which everyone would reject hatred, a world in which everyone would join together to end war forever.
More than 25 nations that helped win the war sent representatives to the peace conference in Paris. All took part in the negotiations. However, the important decisions were made by the so-called Big Four: Prime Minister David Lloyd George of Britain, Premier Georges Clemenceau of France, Premier Vittorio Orlando of Italy, and President Woodrow Wilson of the United States. Wilson hoped the other Allied leaders would accept his plan for a new international organization. The organization would be called the League of Nations. Wilson believed the League could prevent future wars by deciding fair settlements of disputes between nations. He believed it would be the world's only hope for a lasting peace.
Most of the other representatives did not have Wilson's faith in the power of peace, yet they supported his plan for the League of Nations. However, they considered it less important than completing a peace treaty with Germany, and they did not want to spend much time talking about it. They feared that negotiations on the League might delay the treaty and the rebuilding of Europe. Wilson was firm. He demanded that the peace treaty also establish the League. So he led a group at the conference that wrote a plan for the operation of the League. He gave the plan to the European leaders to consider. Then he returned to the United States for a brief visit.
President Wilson soon learned that opposition to the League of Nations existed on both sides of the Atlantic Ocean. Many Americans opposed it strongly. Some Republican senators began criticizing it even before Wilson's ship reached the port of Boston. The senators said the plan failed to recognize America's long-term interests. They said it would take away too many powers from national governments. 37 senators signed a resolution saying the United States should reject the plan for the League of Nations. That was more than the number of votes needed to defeat a peace treaty to which Wilson hoped the League plan would be linked.
The Senate resolution hurt Wilson politically. It was a sign to the rest of the world that he did not have the full support of his people. But he returned to Paris anyway. He got more bad news when he arrived. Wilson's top advisor at the Paris Peace Conference was Colonel Edward House. Colonel House had continued negotiations while Wilson was back in the United States. House agreed with Wilson on most issues. Unlike Wilson, however, he believed the Allies' most urgent need was to reach agreement on a peace treaty with Germany. To do this, House was willing to make many more compromises than Wilson on details for the League of Nations.
Wilson was furious when he learned what House had done. He said, "Colonel House has given away everything I had won before I left Paris. He has compromised until nothing remains. Now I have to start all over again. This time it will be more difficult." For Woodrow Wilson, the most difficult negotiations still lay ahead. That will be our story next week.
Our program was written by Frank Beardsley. The narrators were Barbara Klein and Doug Johnson. You can find our series online with transcripts, MP3s, podcasts, and images at voaspecialenglish.com. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter at VOA Learning English. Join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, an American history series in VOA Special English.